Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl from Carl's Cavern, and glad to have you with us tonight. As always, we have Doc, the producer. Say hello, Doc.
Good evening, everyone. Good to be here.
And our special guest tonight is director Rob Schmidt, good friend, and just really happy to have him. So Rob, say hello.
Hey, you guys. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so just to give everyone a little bit of background, Rob directed the original Wrong Turn and a couple episodes of Master of Horrors and various other things we'll get into. You've got some new projects and some new things you're doing these days. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, Rob.
Cool, man. Yeah. Well, you know, I do true crime stuff for ID Discovery, and then I've been doing a documentary on AIDS in the 80s and 90s, AIDS crisis, and which has been really intense. And I think I'm starting a new horror film called Dweller, actually. I just got the contract for it. Yeah.
Nice. So tell us a little bit about the true crime stuff, because I definitely have not seen it. It's what, a series called Your Worst Nightmare?
Well, yeah, you know, I actually do three different, I direct recreations on three different series that are on ID Discovery. I do Your Worst Nightmare, and I do a series called Swamp Murders, and I do another one called Dead Calm. And they're, there's a number of directors that do them, but those are the shows that I work on, and what they are true crimes, and they interview like survivors when there are survivors, and they interview family members and cops, and then, you know, it's those, the way that I put it, they're like potato chips, you know, like if I'm in a hotel room someplace and I have nothing to do for, you know, 6 hours, I'll like turn on the TV and one of those shows will be on, and then I'll just keep watching them for 6 hours, you know. And they're kind of awesome, but the, what's that?
I was going to say, my mom is officially a fan of yours, by the way. She loves ID Discovery. she will literally sit for hours because she's retired, and she'll watch, I call them the murder shows, and I'm like, boo, how can you watch these murder shows all day and not get depressed? She's like, well, I just can't. Oh, okay. Remember, remind me not to kick you off too badly. You know what you're doing.
Some of them are like super sad. Like, some of them. I did one, and it's about this gal who just keeps getting into really bad domestic abuse situations, and she eventually goes on this road trip with this like killer boyfriend, and it's just like the saddest, most depressing thing, because for the whole hour, you just want her to leave, and she's unable to leave this abusive dude, you know, and then he like rapes and murders her in the woods.
Oh, Jesus. How can you do that? That you're right. That would depress the fuck out of me.
Well, some of the crew, like, they burn out, you know, because it's too hard to do, you know, 6 months of those shows.
Oh, yeah, I would. Yeah, that would take a toll, I would think. Certainly would for me.
Even on, I did Alphabet Killer, and that was about a true crime, too. I mean, it was a fictionalized, you know. And I got a letter from a sister of one of the survivors, and she was really bummed out that we were making the movie, which was sort of a trip. Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I wonder. I'd love to hear why. I'd love to figure out why your mom doesn't get depressed.
Well, you'll have to ask her, Doc.
Yeah.
Me too. Well, she does a lot of reading. She does a lot of other stuff. So it's kind of like a background thing. And she's completely into the whole investigation aspect of it, and the whole, you know, the CSI part, and you know, the autopsy and all that. And I'm just like, okay, Ma. Well, she likes that stuff, and I love horror movies, so I don't know. could be a family thing. I sound bad. I apologize.
I heard a cool thing, actually, that, you know, every story is about a problem. And every story, like, that, for a story to exist, it has to have a character who has a problem in it. And people watch stories so they can learn stuff without having it happen to them. And the reason, like, we like horror films, the reason we like, you know, true crime, like Murder Network or whatever, is because nobody wants to die or be tortured. You know?
True. Well, I should clarify when I say my horror movies, I mean, like, monster movies, the cheeseball stuff that could probably never happen. You know, a giant 300-foot lizard stomping Tokyo is kind of not realistic. You know?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, a guy in a gorilla suit chasing around 1950s ladies. That's my type of horror.
Yeah,
you know,
the one thing about that,
I mean, they used to say, or I used to say, there are two types of people in the world. And those that love horror movies and those that love roller coasters. You know, when you watch a film, there's this separation. You know it's on the screen. It's not real. But you get on a roller coaster, that damn thing is real. It scares the living shit out of me. I don't go on roller coasters. I watch horror movies. I won't go on roller coasters. You know, it's a catharsis, too. I mean, that's why people do it. It's a catharsis.
Yeah, I could see that too. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I guess also, you know, they say one of the reasons people, like teenagers, go to horror films so they can test out their ability to tolerate fear, you know? Like the world is a scary place and a horror film is a place where you can like go and sit and have like the most monstrous things happen. And then if you can't handle it, you can just leave the theater or whatever, shut the thing off.
Exactly. Now getting back to the Alphabet Murders, I've never seen this film, so I've got to look for it, and we'll talk about where to find these and that sort of thing. But I'm looking at this cast. This cast is amazing. You worked with really good people.
Yeah, I was really psyched on that one. You were talking about Carl Lumley before, and he's awesome on that. He does his you should check out, if you like him, you should check out his performance. He's like really kind of beautiful, and it's sad and sort of great, I think, isn't it?
Well, the reason I mentioned Carl Lumley to you, particularly for our listeners, if they don't know who the actor is, in Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, he was John Parker. And I've loved him ever since that. Seriously. But I mean, you know, you work with Tom Noonan. Tom Noonan's one of my favorite actors of all time.
He's pretty amazing, yeah. Yeah, he's so cool. He's like a really great guy, too.
You know, he, of course, he was Frankenstein and the Monster Squad, but he just did a run, finished up a run on 12 Monkeys, the TV show. He's just phenomenal. And, of course, Melissa Leo, I think she won an Oscar. I'm not sure.
Yeah, she won an Oscar. She did, yeah.
She won an Oscar. You worked with an Oscar winner, you know, before she won the Oscar, but still.
Well, Tim Hutton's in it. He had won an Oscar, like, years ago, you know.
Yeah, for Ordinary People.
Ordinary People, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Cary Elwes, who, of course, you know, the Princess Bride, Wesley and the Princess Bride, Elijah Dushku, Michael Ironside, Bill Moseley. Good God. That must have been an absolute blast to do that, to work with those people.
Yeah, it was super fun. I love all those people, too, so it was really cool. It was awesome. It was
you know,
rough, though, you know. Like, yeah, I didn't get to spend as much time as I would have liked. You know, actually, and Martin Donovan, too, actually worked with Melissa Leo. They did their scenes together. And they did an interesting thing. They were playing a couple. Melissa Leo and Martin Donovan were playing a couple whose daughter had been murdered, you know. And they would do this thing that was, they were getting interviewed by Eliza Dushku, who plays a cop, you know, and they would do this thing before the scenes, before we would roll camera, where they would just say the meanest shit to each other, like, fuck you, you're a fucking whore, I hate you, bitch, you know. And she would be shrieking at them, and then they would quiet down, I would call action, and then they would start the scene and act like they were, you know, a couple being polite to the police.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Ooh. It was so, like, great to see that happen, you know.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, being a director and then seeing actors' processes, I mean, you know, you work with actors and that sort of thing, but to see something like that, it's got to be, wow.
Yeah, that was awesome. It was awesome to see that, and to see, you know, the result of it is that they're, like, really trying to be calm, and they're, like, out of breath, and they're agitated, you know, but they're, like, acting very polite. And you couldn't just pull that out of your ass, you know. You have to do prep for it.
Mm-hmm. Now that,
I love when actors are doing that. They actually, like, do physical prep to get into a scene.
I have done some theater work and particularly behind the scenes. This is years ago, but you would, I, even at that level, which was off Broadway in New York, you would see that too. And it always did amaze me, the ability that they have to control their bodies and to get what they want out of it for the particular scene. It just, you know, it really is something to see firsthand.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit. Okay, go ahead. Finish. I'm sorry.
No, you go, please. No, you go.
Well, I was just going to say, why don't you give us a little background of how you got started in the business and all that sort of good stuff.
Okay. Let me think. I went to film school, and then I started working. Before I was out of film school, I worked, my first job was, I was a scenic painter on the Hall & Oates music video with Daryl Hannah. And I never met Daryl Hannah or Hall & Oates. I just painted walls. But it was awesome to be on film sets. And then I kept working, worked as a PA, then I worked in camera departments and grip and electric departments, and then I went to grad school at AFI, and a couple of years after that, I did my first movie, Saturn, and it was Lionsgate retitled it Speed of Life. And before that, I did some music videos for, like, The Descendants and Possum Dixon and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That was kind of it. I started working.
Okay, but you know, the one thing that I've noticed being, and we were talking to another guest, a gentleman by the name of Joel Weinkoop, you know, when you're in the level of what you're doing and that sort of thing, you know, certainly we're not talking someone like Steven Spielberg or anything like that. The amount of work that you do and the amount of hustling, and I know you got some projects that you're trying to get, you know, money behind and so on and so forth. You know, why don't you just give our listeners an idea of what that entails?
Boy, you know, I think that, like, I don't drink. I haven't had a drink in, like, about 19 years. And when I started working, I was drinking. And I think if I hadn't been, you know, a heavy drinker, I wouldn't have been in this industry. Because it's really hard, you know, to get projects going, and you need to be a little crazy to keep trying to get people to give you money for stuff. Like, it just, you know, there's big long periods where nothing's happening, you know, and you need to have really strong nerves to keep going with it, or you need to be a little crazy, I think, to keep going with it. Yeah, and you're always hustling, and I bet I have, you know, over the years, like, been attached to and then had go away, I bet like 20 movies, you know, that people wanted to make, like we're like, yes, we're going to make it. We're going to get this star. We're going to get that star. It goes on for 2 or 3 years and then it just fades away. So.
Yeah, it's got to be frustrating. I mean, I know, you know, with what we're doing here with the podcast group and that sort of thing, it can be frustrating. And we're doing something very small and that sort of thing. But to do a film and be in that, I mean, how do you keep doing it?
I think if you have a really dysfunctional childhood, then it's easier because you just expect the world to be like that.
I can actually kind of agree with that. I never thought of it that way. Oh, good Lord. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I know you've got a couple of projects. One that we talked about previously when you were on KSDAD. Fran K, what is happening with Fran K at this point? Tell our listeners what it is, because I find this absolutely fascinating. This should be bought.
That project, that's one of those things that, you know, I could get bummed out about it, but I do not. Fran K is it's like a retelling of Frankenstein, kind of mashed up with the Eileen Wuornos story, you know, that killer prostitute, and it's a queer story. The Frankenstein monster is a queer girl, and I made a pilot for it that I think is awesome, and it's actually in the last 2 weeks it went out again. It went out to an executive at Netflix and an executive at Sci-Fi, but I haven't heard anything. And I made that in the spring, I guess. I made that in the spring, and there hasn't been any traction on it yet. So I think it's going to be one of those things that just goes away, you know.
Well, that's a shame, because I remember you sent me the trailer for it, and I'll have to dig it up and attach it to Deviant Legion. But it looked absolutely fantastic.
Excuse me, gentlemen, we have a caller.
Oh, okay.
It does look very, very good. Here's our caller. If I can get him in the system. Hello. Okay, there we go. Hello, caller 941. Hello.
Hi, it's me, Mika.
Hey, Mika, how are you?
I'm good, actually. I've been driving for the last hour, and I had to pull over so I can call in.
Okay. Mika, I want to introduce everyone to Mika. Mika is now officially going to be part of the Deviant Legion. We had a show last week that I thought she did very, very well on, and she's going to be an official guest host. So we all want to welcome Mika to the fold. So yay!
Yay!
Yay! Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I didn't mean to crash in on your show.
Oh yes, you did. We talked about it.
Oh, just throw me under the bus.
Why not?
Wait, I'm a
have a question for Rob, do you? Mika?
Not in particular. I do like Wrong Turn. I don't know if you guys talked about it because I've been driving. I do like Wrong Turn because at the time when it came out, it came from a very different angle for horror movies, and I was just wondering what made you want to put your energy into making that movie. Like, what made you want to make this up for the big screen?
Oh, I just hi, by the way, congratulations on getting on the show. I think that's really cool.
Thank you.
You know, the thing about Wrong Turn was people were making sort of like silly horror films then, or where they winked at the audience, and I really wanted to make a movie that sorry, I'm a frog in my mouth. I wanted to make a movie that took itself really seriously, where the characters, you know, were played just totally straight, and you cared about them, and they were in a real struggle, you know, and that was kind of where that came from, and
Right.
I wanted it to feel
reliable.
Like, and I wanted it to feel, you know, kind of like a nightmare, but also like you could really be trapped there. Like,
right, because like at the time when that came out, I think it was still kind of hooked on the one killer chasing all the teens, and that was really way more realistic for people who take road trips and stuff. Like, it could happen to anybody.
Yeah.
It definitely got me thinking what roads to take when I travel now.
I love that. That's awesome.
You put that fear in a lot of people.
it's also different, you know, at the time you were doing a lot of the Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger and that sort of thing. And this is much more, I always felt it had a lot to owe to Deliverance.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know,
definitely,
and more a 70s vibe than anything else. And of course I grew up in the 70s. So I think it's an absolutely wonderful film.
Yeah, we were really trying to embrace the 70s vibe, you know, in it. And I think even some of the camera movement feels like a 70s movie. Like we did some like really slow zoom ins and, you know, whatnot that were used a lot in that period. And I think the color actually looks kind of 70s too.
Mm-hmm. And of course, why don't you talk a little bit about... Oh, sorry, Mika. Go ahead.
Oh, he was talking about with the 70s vibe, and like you definitely got that from watching the movie, especially with the guys driving around in the old truck and stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, you had to depend on your wits and not technology how to get out of a situation, which I thought was genius, because nowadays a lot of people's like, oh, just use the cell phone or just use this. So, you know, you really make that point real clear that, you know, you have to use your own wits to get out of a situation.
Yeah, you know, another thing in that movie that is weird and was great, and I couldn't have, I just kind of like stood by and watched it happen, was Stan Winston and Shane Mahan making those creatures, you know, the three killers. And there's a thing that actually still sticks in my head is that, you know, there's a bunch of scenes are in daylight, and Stan was concerned about seeing the creatures in daylight, you know. But I know in the big field, do you remember when Desmond Harrington got shot in the leg? Like,
yes.
He was worried that the creatures looked too foamy, you know, like that the prosthetics looked too foamy in it. But I was really excited to like have that type of character in broad daylight. It seemed like it could make broad daylight scary.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. You don't see a lot of bad guys or the air quotes monsters out in the daylight. It's usually in the dark or, you know, in the middle of a rainstorm. So that was really, really cool. And the special effects on it were fantastic. Like the girl who gets ripped in half, I found that very impressive. I was like, ooh, that was cool.
That's a really fun moment to see with an audience in a theater, because people start screaming and then it gets quiet. And when they realize what's happening, you know, with the body falling, that people start screaming again.
That's what you want, though, as a director. You want to keep them on the edge of their seat.
Yeah, those are like cheers, you know. If you're directing a horror film, when the audience screams, you're winning the game.
Well, Carl, I really didn't mean to bust up your interview, Rob. I just wanted to tell you I love
Pitbull.
The movie. It's one of my favorites.
Stick with us if you want.
I have to get back on the road, guys. I have to get home.
all right. Fair enough. Mika, thanks so much for calling. Really appreciate it.
No
yeah,
problem.
Nice
and by the way, welcome to the fold, my dear. Nice to have you
thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you. I feel honored. Honestly, I do.
Oh,
and I wanted to tell Rob, right. Thank you. Your movie is one of my top three horror movies. I love it.
Oh, that's sweet.
All right, guys. You take care.
All right, Mika, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
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 So, Rob, tell us a little bit about working with Stan Winston. I mean, that had to be comfort.
Yeah. He was a trip. He was like an amazing. I in hindsight, it was like having a dad who was helping you and was kind and a teacher. And he used to say that he had, like, his shtick was being like a nice grandpa, you know. Like, he was like, everybody has a shtick, and some people, their shtick is being mean. Some people, their shtick is being, you know, like the smartest guy in the room. And my shtick is being nice grandpa. And but he was a genius, you know. He was, like, literally a genius. Like, I remember going on plane rides with him and, you know, when we'd go to festivals or whatever, and he'd bring a sketch pad with him, and he would just, like, draw original characters while we were sitting on the plane. He was just a really inspired, like, charming, funny man. He was, like, great. And his office was crazy. It was, like, there was Stan Winston Studios, and they had all the fabrication stuff and all that. And it was, like, an industrial warehouse, you know, with all these people working. And his office was, like, above it all in the warehouse, maybe, like, three stories up. And it had, like, mirrored windows. Had mirrored windows so he could look out over the whole, like, warehouse workshop areas. And he had all these creatures. It was super dark in his office with, like, spotlights. And he had all these creatures that he designed, you know, all over Stan Winston Studios. There's all these, you know, Terminator and Jurassic Park and Beetlejuice and just all these, like, I bet a third of the creatures that you know from Hollywood films, you know, he had made. And just all sitting around. But in his office, there was all that. And he had, like, six Academy Awards that were just sitting there. And he had, like, a clay station where he was, like carving a bust of a creature. And he said all this amazing shit. He actually, before my partner and I got pregnant with our first daughter, I was nervous about having kids, you know, and I actually asked Stan about it, which sounds weird, but I went to have a meeting with him to just hang out and ask him about, you know, having kids, which sounds insane, but I guess, like, my dad had passed away a long time before that, and so I guess I was looking to Stan in that way. And I was sitting in his office, you know, and he's behind his desk with all of this stuff around and his six Academy Awards. And he said, my greatest achievement is my son and daughter. Like, and he was like, you know, that's it. That's the thing that's the most important. And that actually made me, not that guys have any choice. Women decide whether you're going to have kids or not, you know, but that made me feel good about having kids.
Good. Good. Well, you know, you did say he was the grandpa. I mean, you know, we look to older people to guide us and be mentors and that sort of thing. And certainly, you know, given that's your third film, and you work with someone like that, that has got to have a real effect on you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I never thought about it until now, actually, when we're talking. But it did, and he was a great man, you know. He really was.
Mm-hmm.
His
work speaks for himself, and certainly, you know, from what we're hearing from you, you know, that goes far beyond his work. So, yeah, Stan Winston, I always had a great respect for him. Always loved his stuff. So another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was your work on Masters of Horror and then, of course, Fear Itself. And how did that come about?
Let me think. You know, I think Stephen King had a list of, like, his top 10 films, you know, the year Wrong Turn came out, and Wrong Turn was his favorite movie. And then that got so there was good attention for Wrong Turn, and I think that was why I got on Masters of Horror, you know. And boy, you know, I really like that episode, and I don't show it much because it has, like, Showtime in that period, they had a lot of, you know, they would make a lot of movies where there'd be women with giant breasts topless. And then Masters of Horror, have you guys seen Masters of Horror, the series?
Oh, yeah,
they're
absolutely.
Like, yeah, they're like, I mean, some of them are better than others, but they're, you know, they're really interesting, other than me, important horror directors who, like, making these one-hour movies. But then they have, like, they have a bunch of nudity in them, you know? And Martin Donovan and Corbin Burnson were in mine, and it's a story that I really like a lot, and I like the work that everyone did, and but it has you know, some big naked women, big boob naked women in it, and it kind of makes I wonder if this is making the audience want to see it or not want to see it.
The episode is called Right to Die. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the story of it?
Oh yeah, totally. It's so it's Right to Die, and it's about a a man who is getting prepared to divorce his wife, and they get into an accident. They're on the road driving at night, and they get into an accident, and she almost burns to death in the accident, and she's in the hospital, and she's on life support, and he has to decide whether to pull the plug or not. And he's tormented, you know, and he goes home, and he's thinking that they're going to pull the plug, and then she flatlines, and when she flatlines, her ghost comes to his home and torments him and tortures him to, you know, as if he's in hell. And so he changes his mind and decides that, you know, he wants her to live, and because of the ghost torturing him. And then it turns out that she's going to die anyway, because she doesn't have, you know, she's burned over most of her body, and she needs, like, skin transplants and things like that. And he's slowly going mad through the course of the episode, and he skins his mistress so that he can provide skin for his wife's skin grafts. But she dies anyway. Yeah, dies anyway, and so he's in hell forever. That's what that episode is.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like a Masters of Horror episode.
Yeah, and it's pretty funny, actually,
awesome.
Too. Yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to say, as it turns out, pig skin, you can use fresh pig skin, and it looks like human skin, and you can slice and make blood come out of it. So just note to filmmakers out there that that's an excellent way to fake a skinning.
That brings up a nice question. You know, the technique of all the special effects of horror movies and that sort of thing. As a director, do you have direct input on that, or do you leave it to your special effects director?
Or is it
a combination of both?
Yeah, like when you're a director, like anything that goes wrong in the movie, you get blamed for, and anything that goes right, usually you get credit for, unless it's like a great performance, and then the actor gets credit for it, you know. And you're really working as like a systems manager, and like you get all these really talented people together, hopefully, and they come up with things, and you kind of steer them, and so it's a combination. But like what you do is you get really talented people and they pitch you stuff, and sometimes you'll know a way to do something that someone else doesn't, but generally it's about managing experts, you know.
Okay, that's a good insight, you know. And of course you did the follow-up series, which a lot of people don't realize was Fear Itself. And that came on a couple years later.
Yeah, yeah. And Yeah, and that they changed the title because they thought, I think NBC thought it was too, it would be too, they didn't want, they wanted to get away from graphic horror, I guess, so they changed the title. Yeah, that was cool too, and I did that with Martin Donovan, and why am I forgetting her name? She's a giant movie star.
Anna Kendrick.
Yeah, Anna Kendrick's, which is really cool, and, and that was super fun. It was a little weird to shoot. We shot in Edmonton, Canada, which is it was a rough place to shoot. And I think it's like super far north, and we were shooting in the summer, and there was like 5 hours a night. Like literally, I remember I was driving with one of the producers, and he was calling LA, and he was talking to his friend when I was in the car, and he was like, "It's 11 p.m. It was so funny. It was still sunny out at 11 p.m., you know? It was really fucked up. To shoot a horror series where it's mostly all set at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what, you had to shoot like at 2 or 3 in the morning then in that case?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We would shoot I think it would start to get bright out by like 4 a.m., it was like these tiny windows that you were able to shoot.
Good God.
Kind of beautiful. It's kind of beautiful, though.
Yeah, it sounds like you're above the Arctic Circle. I actually have had some experience with that. I was in Tromsø for a while up in Norway when I was very young. I remember my mom telling me to go to bed, go to bed, go to bed. No, but the sun's still out. She's like, look. 24 hours a day of sunlight, go to bed at 9 o'clock. Okay. I'll always remember that.
That's really cool. That's super cool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the last couple of years, you've been doing some really good stuff. now, The Swamp Murders and Dead Silent and Your Worst Nightmare we talked about, but you did a documentary, and I find it interesting. 2012, you did The Worst Thing About Coming Out, and you have another LGTB documentary you're working on presently. So I just wondered, how did that come about? You know, an interest.
Personally, I'm straight, but honestly, when I was a kid, I got called faggot so many times that I've always felt like an outsider, you know, and I wanted to support folks who were outsiders, and that was why the Worst Thing About Coming Out project came up. And then this new project, The Good From Our War, which is it's about the AIDS crisis in the pre-protease era when there were just like, you know, massive deaths, whole groups of people, whole neighborhoods would die out, and a friend of mine was applying for grants, and she needed a filmmaker to apply with, and so we partnered on that. But that's been really mind-blowing, actually, and I've been getting to spend time with some really amazing people. Do you guys know the group ACT UP?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story when you're finished, so go ahead. Oh, yeah, I know exactly ACT UP.
Well, I'll just tell you this, because I really want to hear your story, is I was with a documentarian this last week. I was in upstate New York with a documentarian from ACT UP, Matt Ebert, and he handed me original film footage from all of the major ACT UP actions, some of which no one has ever seen, and the one at the CDC in Atlanta, and the one at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and I think it's called The Day of Rage in Albany, New York, and so I'm carrying with me this box with this, you know, 25 year old collection of rare film, and I'm terrified something's going to happen to it before I get it to this archive in Atlanta. Like, I feel like I've been trusted with something, you know, really precious. It's a precious piece of history. Okay, tell me your story.
So you know, it's funny. You mentioned being called faggot. I had the same exact experience. I had some physical problems when I was younger, and I had braces on until I was 8, and though the braces were off, and if you looked at me now, you wouldn't even tell. But, you know, my physicality was rough in that, and we moved to a little town called Bradford, Pennsylvania, which happens to be one of the most redneck places on the face of the earth. I do have a love-hate relationship with the place. But because of that, and also I got involved in a theater in Bradford, community theater, and I met a friend of mine. And I think I mentioned, in fact, I know I mentioned him to you. His name is Richard Wandel, and Richard was actually part of ACT UP, and he was the librarian for the gay archives in New York for a number of years. But I got to be very close friends with him, and then I moved to New York in 1981, worked with Carl Fisher, music publisher, and they had a store. And I worked in the choral band orchestra department, print music, and about 60-70% of our clientele was gay. So during that time, I was at like about 20 funerals, and I was at least three times I was pallbearer to people who had passed away from AIDS.
Good
so
Lord.
Yeah. I mean, it's really something. And so over the years, very much like you, I'm straight, but I've been such a supporter of rights, because just like anything else, I think if you run into something when you're young, you know, or anytime, you know, something like that, that you start to understand what other people and other groups go through just because of who they are. And so you get that realization, and you know, hopefully, you know, that realization changes you and changes you for the better, to be more accepting and more loving. So that's my story.
Yeah, that's amazing. You're going to the 20 funerals just reminded me, I did an interview with this psychiatrist who he was like an out psychiatrist in the, you know, 1980s, and out flamboyant, like very promiscuous gay man who was a psychiatrist, you know, and then his practice, and then AIDS happened. And this was back when like people would go to a psychiatrist and see him like an hour a week, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like where you go in for 10 minutes or whatever to get a prescription for a drug. And his whole practice became men that were dying of AIDS, you know, not just men, folks that were dying of AIDS. Like every single slot in his practice was that. And he had 100 funeral cards in his appointment book. Like he still has the appointment book from the period. And every time one of his patients would die, he would go to the funeral and put their funeral card in his appointment book, you know, because he did his appointments by hand. It was back in the 80s and 90s, and he wouldn't see them anymore because they were dead. And he had 100 of those before he stopped, like this big, thick appointment book. And then do you want to hear some of these stories? Because some of them just, like, kill me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I interviewed this doctor who his practice became I've always been suspicious of doctors because they get paid, you know, the same as professional sports players. And I've always been a little suspicious of them. And this guy kind of blew my mind because he one of the things he said was, if you want to make money, you know, you go work as a stockbroker. Doctors become doctors because they're affirmation junkies. They want people to, like, tell them that they did good and that they appreciate them. And he said, and for 15 years, I failed every single patient I had, and they all died. Like, everybody died. And this is the thing he said that, like, changed my mind about doctors. As he said there was a point in the process with AIDS where they would get an infection that you would know how long they would have to live. Like, it would be 2 weeks, or it would be 4 weeks, or, you know, this usually takes 6 weeks and then it kills you. And he said, and I'd go into my examining room and I'd see one of my patients from my practice, and I would realize they had the infection that was going to kill them. And he said, and a lot of doctors, they want to paint a rosy picture and they don't want to tell you bad news, but I feel that it's my responsibility to give people honest information about what's happening to them so they have whatever control they can have of their life. And he said, when I would meet one of my patients and they would have the infection that was going to kill them, I would excuse myself and go to my bathroom and I would throw up, and then I would go back into the room and tell them how long they had to live. When Jesus. He said that, yeah, I was like, holy shit, I have not in my life had a conversation that made me throw up. And this guy had, you know, over 100 of them. And it made me decide that, you know, doctors earn every penny they get, you know, like, to do that. Like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah. That's really something. I do hope that this comes to fruition. What's the status of this project right now, Rob?
It'll, well, by the end of April, we'll have a 30-minute rough cut, and then we'll get funding. We'll start searching for funding to make a feature-length version of it. I think that one will get done and get released because the content is you know, important, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that just brings up something we talked about previously, that, you know, as an independent, you do these things, and then you have to go get funding, and you have to do all that work to get the final edition. So how long does a project like this take from, you know, start to finish?
I don't even want to think about it. it depends, you know, like I bet that'll be 3 or 4 years, you know, to get that done and out. It's different, like, when you're getting a, you know, when you're a hired gun, there's a schedule and stuff just gets cranked out and released, but indie projects can take forever, you know?
Yeah. And again, as you said previously, you know, it's probably good that you're a little crazy.
Yeah.
Or ribbon or whatever the case would be to have that sort of commitment to a project. I mean, it's really something. I don't know our listeners really understand that, and understand that it's working, not just, you know, doing the work, directing or whatever you do on a set or a documentary. It's the funding, it's the constant trying to sell the project. All that is involved in it. So, you know, that was something, you know. Now, do you want to just, you know, this project, this documentary seems to have a lot of personal pull over you. Is there anything else you want to say about it? One other story?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Boy, well, you know, some of the... Actually, there's a thing that has... my co-invest, they call them co-investigators for the grant that we have. My co-investigator on it is a doctor. She's a ICU doctor and pulmonary ICU. And she's more conscious of like lawsuits and legal actions, you know, than I am. And some of the folks that we interview, they talk about death parties, you know, where they would someone would decide to rather than die in the ICU or whatever, they would die in their home with their friends around them, you know, by assisted suicide or by suicide or whatnot. And a bunch of that stuff is illegal, you know, and in a lot of states it's illegal. And so these folks who were, you know, just super heroic and were like helping, you know, their lovers and their like friends and whatnot, like pass with dignity, by like talking about it, they were exposing themselves to murder charges. Like still.
Wow.
Yeah, which I was just like, what? How can that be? You know, but it actually is a real thing. And like, there are people that would, you know, if you're a district attorney in like a county that is really conservative, that becomes like a political thing to do, to like charge somebody for doing that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned out that by not turning that footage over to the police, I've become an accessory to murder after the fact. And so we had to have a bunch of legal, actually about 10 grand in legal legal work done to like protect everybody on that stuff, which never occurred. Yeah, isn't that crazy that by hearing a story you can be an accessory to murder?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you just blew me away.
Me too.
Yeah.
So just to finish up, can you say anything about the new project that's coming out, the horror movie that you mentioned?
Boy, well, it's I don't know when it's coming out, but it's getting shot apparently in the next 2 months. And I literally like just before the show got the first pass of the contract, so I think it's happening, and it's called Dweller. And it's a little bit like Wrong Turn. It's not a lot, but it's a little like Wrong Turn. And I don't really want to say anything else about it yet. So. But I'm psyched to be getting to make it. And it'll shoot down in Atlanta, in Georgia.
Well, I tell you what, really good luck with that. Do you have anything else? You know, one thing I do know is that you teach. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I teach. I started when my daughters were little. Exactly what happened is that I was up in Vancouver working, and my older daughter was 3, and she came up to visit, and she was really excited. We were in the Sutton, which is in Vancouver, the hotel that, like, you know, if you're on film productions, you live in, and so there's all sorts of interesting people there. And my daughter was in the elevator with my ex and a bunch of strangers. And she went up to the strangers and she said, my daddy lives in a hotel house. And my ex was like, no, he doesn't. Daddy lives with us, you know. But my 3-year-old was right, you know. I didn't live with them. I lived like on location. And so I decided I would start teaching so that I would be, you know, I would do less film work and I'd be close to my girls when they were growing up. And the reason I started getting busy again is because they're old enough now that they don't really want to hang out with me.
it's called puberty.
Yeah. Like, they want to hang out with me just in very limited doses, you know.
By the way, that video that I saw on Facebook, was that your daughter?
Yeah, that's my daughter.
So explain that, because I watched that and I said, oh my God.
she can't stop herself from talking back. Like, I'll be like, hey, why don't you tie your shoes? And she'll be like, da 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 da.
And I was like, I can't remember what she was even talking back about, but I was like, Maya, you have to clean the kitchen because you were talking back. Then she talked back again, and I was like, you need to make a film about why it's good to talk back. And that was her film about talking back.
There you go. she seems adorable, but I bet you she keeps you going for sure.
Yeah, she's a piece of work. But
how old is she now?
She's 12. That one's 12. Yeah, she's awesome. It's a little scary. So people told me that she has a southern accent in that video, and just like, whoa, you know, we moved to the south, and now my daughters have southern accents. It's just fine. It's punishment for making wrong turn, I guess.
Well, something like that, I guess. Well, Rob, I want to, again, thank you so much for being on. It's always a pleasure to have you, and you're always welcome. When you've got a new project or anything like that, just get in contact. You're on here immediately.
Not a
problem.
Thanks a lot, you guys. It was really fun talking.
Okay, well,
thank
you very much, Rob, for coming in, and go back to being a dad for Maya, all right?
Okay, man.
Thank
bye-bye.
You so much.
Okay, bye. Care. Bye-bye. So Doc, what do we have going here this weekend?
Well, right now we have a podcast. Right now we have a podcast. I'm kidding. Actually, this Sunday we have, it's one of those nights. I'm wired on caffeine. My sense of humor is all over the place. So this Sunday we have the anti-Oscar show on the Sludge Pit. And you know what we're going to be doing? We're going to be watching the movie Frogs. Yes, the nature gone nuts movie with frogs and alligators and everything that, well, Sam Elliott, without a mustache.
Sam
Elliott
is Australian, okay? Sam Elliott is Texan.
Yeah, Sam Elliott has... I always get those two confused for some reason. I know they're completely different actors. But anyway, yeah. So Sam Elliott gets to fight a very, very pissed off Mother Nature in Frogs. And we're going to be doing a live commentary. It's going to be me and Carl, possibly some other random call-ins. So we'll see what happens with that. It's going to be on Sunday at 8 p.m., hopefully. The reason why I say hopefully because we're in for
we've got a possible windstorm with hurricane winds coming in to Doc's area on Sunday. So we'll have to see if it happens. If not, well, we're scheduled early in the week. But one thing, too, is the reason we're doing it is because Sam Elliott is up for an Oscar. And we thought you would want to see Sam Elliott without his mustache.
Yeah, so that's going to throw a lot of people off because I was talking to Boo earlier about Frogs, and she's like, Sam Elliott was in that. I'm like, yeah, without a mustache. And she just went, oh, my God, I never thought I'd see that. So,
yeah. Yep, so we're going to do that. Then, of course, we've got a show on Thursday with Christoph. I don't know what I'm doing next Friday yet. But I will do something, I can guarantee you. And again, we want to thank everyone. We want to thank Rob for coming in and talking to us. It's always a pleasure to have him. He's a great guy, and he does really good work. And we want to thank you for being with us tonight. So I guess that's it, Doc, right? Anything else?
Oh, we have one more thing. We have one more thing. On Tuesday, tentatively, depending if we have power here and, you know, nothing gets too crazy, there will be an episode of Doc Sludge's Toxic Cinema, and I do have an idea for a weird little movie for me to talk about. So if everything doesn't go crazy, there will be an episode of Doc Sludge's Toxic Cinema on Tuesday.
Okay.
And, yeah, we're good to go.
Okay, well, listen, again, thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you soon here at Carl's Cavern. Okay. Bye.
Cavern. Bye, everybody. Good night and rest well.
Good night.